Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and today's conversation is with Craig Fugate, Administrator of the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Dave Abel. Craig, FEMA's role during disasters is spelled out in the Stafford Act. Would you provide an overview of the Stafford Act and the more recent post-Katrina Emergency Management Reform Act? And how has that latter Reform Act expanded your authority?
Okay, well, let's start with the Stafford Act. Again, it's sometimes I feel like I have to back up and start out with high school civics at times because there's this assumption that we have what I call a national system that FEMA manages and directs response to disasters. The reality is governors and local officials direct and respond to disasters, many of which will never result in federal assistance. And it is the federal system that is the cornerstone of the Stafford Act that essentially says that all disasters are local. It doesn't say that specifically, but the implication is that until a disaster overwhelms the state's ability to effectively manage it with state resources, it is the responsibility of the state's governor and their team to support local response. But when it does warrant, and oftentimes that is a financial threshold of a declaration, a governor may request from the president that the state is declared a disaster area and that certain provisions of the program are turned on. In many disasters, the response has already been concluded by local responders before that request ever reaches FEMA. So I'd say 90% of our disasters, many of which won't make the national headlines, were based upon a response that state and local government responded, but is in the recovery, particularly the financial impacts of that recovery and rebuilding and the cost of response, that states have requested that assistance, the president's concurred. And so much of the time, FEMA's job as administering the Stafford Act is the reimbursement parts of the program. So that was the model going into many of these larger disasters that oftentimes produce a sense of frustration. People oftentimes describe FEMA as the federal 911 system, when the reality was FEMA was basically built around reimbursing for previous disasters, and that very few disasters really exercise the authorities FEMA had on behalf of the president to coordinate federal response. And you saw that in several disasters, most notably the Katrina response, where it was implied that FEMA may not have the authority to pre-position or order up supplies or to commit resources until the governor has made that formal request. Congress recognized that they needed to clarify that. So one of the things that happened with the post-Katrina Emergency Management Reform Act is FEMA is not precluded from ordering up response, whether it be contracting for resources or tasking Department of Defense or other parts of the federal family prior to the governor's request. And I'll give you an example. America Samoa was struck by a tsunami earlier this year. Earthquake occurred off the coast. A tsunami struck the islands. Notification came in to us in the early afternoon. I was able to communicate with our Region 9 folks that were getting the initial reports of the damages. We were able to converse with the governor. From that, historically, what would have happened, we'd had to send teams onto the island to assess it and see how bad it was, help the governor formulate a request and get the paperwork into the White House and get that approved. And then we would turn around and determine what assistance the governor needed based upon their assessments, and then we'd order up those resources and we'd send them down there. Well, that works pretty good if the disaster is well within the capabilities of the state to respond to, and then we're just talking about recovery. This was not the case in America Samoa with the tsunami. So we used the authorities under the post-Katrina Emergency Management Reform Act. One, we started sending things based upon the population of the islands. We weren't sure how bad it was, but we knew the population of the islands, so we started mobilizing those resources. We knew it had to go in by air because ships would take too long, and we had to make sure we had a runway. So we worked with our partners in DHS, Coast Guard, and TSA, A, to make sure the runways were usable, and two, to use Coast Guard aircraft to fly in the first teams. And we made it very clear we weren't flying down to do assessments. We were flying down there to provide support. And based upon the governor's initial descriptions, we asked the White House to approve the governor's verbal request for a major presidential disaster declaration with no assessments. From the time of this event to the declaration made was less than 8 hours. From the time our first team was on the ground was literally limited by the fact that they had to clear off one of the runways. But within 24 hours, we had our first teams on the ground. And we had set the goal of stabilizing the response in 72 hours. And the governor reported to us that he considered the island stabilized within 48 hours. And that his primary focus was now switching to power generation because they lost a power plant. So we worked with the Corps of Engineers and our partners at the Department of Defense to fly in generators to provide that assistance. Now, that model is the way we operate. Oftentimes, the description of our programs is disasters happen locally. It exceeds their capabilities. It goes to the state. They assess. It sees their capabilities. It comes to us. It almost describes dominoes have to fall before we can engage. And that is not how we operate. And the Post-Katrina Emergency Management Reform Act made it clear that was not Congress's intent. That oftentimes on small disasters where the response was handled by the states, yes, we do look at impacts, we do the assessments, and we determine if it warrants it. But in disasters where it is evident that a response is needed, that we cannot wait for the assessments, we are no longer precluded from providing that direct response and that assistance in a very timely manner.
Craig, what is a catastrophic disaster? Could you describe that for us? And more importantly, what's the role of the federal government during an incident like that? And then the major challenges in responding to a catastrophic disaster.
A catastrophic disaster has no set definition, and that's one of the challenges. I think that my working definition to me has always been when a disaster is such magnitude that the jurisdiction closest to the disaster no longer has the capability to manage the response and recovery. And that is not to imply that they were incompetent. Oftentimes, this implies that they may have become so involved in a disaster, they may be part of the impact in itself and no longer can effectively respond. There are some events that could be so large that it actually overwhelms a state's ability. So I look at catastrophic not by a set threshold or numbers, but really looking at when the closest level of government to the disaster loses its ability to manage it, then if that's a small community that got hit by a tornado and may only be 1,000 people, but they lost all of their governance, there's no response, there's no ability for them to manage the response, even if we sent help there, there's nothing to latch on to, that local government has been rendered incapacitated by disaster. Now, that's catastrophic. It may not be catastrophic to the state or federal government, but to that level, it's catastrophic. So we look at the federal side. When do we see events that are such magnitude that our normal response and our capabilities in the federal family would be exceeded? And we need to, again, leverage early in the process to private sector. And this is where I find that in trying to take systems that are built around reimbursements or built around these smaller, more manageable disasters and trying to scale up, they won't work. My analogy is I can only pedal a bicycle so fast. So I'm trying to change our direction and plan for what would occur in catastrophic disasters that exceed the federal capability and really requires us to build that partnership and that team in the private sector and community-based resources and then look at how we scale that down. So give you an example like on housing. Temporary housing is a finite number. There's only so many units that you could bring in to augment housing before you reach a theoretical maximum that the only other alternative is to relocate people out of the area. Something that many local officials do not want to do. But it is a pragmatic issue. You can only bring in so much capability so fast before you're really in a situation where it makes more sense to move people to where housing and sheltering may be available outside of the area. And so again, when you look at different aspects of the program, you start reaching thresholds that say events bigger than this, you're probably going to have to move people out of the area for extended periods of time. An example would be like the New Madrid earthquake, where we could literally lose hundreds of thousands, if not, you know, close to 500,000 housing units across the multi-state area. So unlikely there would be available housing or you could bring enough housing there quickly, particularly if it was in winter or some other time of the season where exposure becomes a huge issue, that you would have no other option than to relocate people. So that starts driving the planning to say if you're at that threshold, then the plan should be we relocate people with the game plan that we bring them home at some point. And what are the conditions you have to set for that?
So it's interesting that a lot of our questions have been about response and a lot of your answers to those questions have been about planning. Can you tell us a little bit more about FEMA's Catastrophic Disaster Planning Initiative and specifically, how does that define the roles of planning between the government and your partners?
We need to have a reference point that gives us an opportunity to look at what stresses the system. When do things reach the point where oftentimes the coping mechanisms that exist every day will fail? And by looking at particularly natural hazards where we have existing threats based upon either geographical location or a hazard that's geospecific, such as an earthquake fault zone, is to take the scenarios that can happen, both looking at historical, but also looking at what the theoretical that can occur, model it, and then run that against the existing systems and see where it fails. I think this is the real advantage of catastrophic planning in my mind is it takes us to the point where our normal everyday coping mechanisms that we have in government, communities, and in the private sector are broken. And it forces us to look at how we have to build the capability and the team to address those issues. What catastrophic planning does to me is it takes us past what we're capable of doing. That's where planning oftentimes stops. We'll plan to what we're capable of and either hope or through ignorance think it can never get any worse. I like to take it to the point where those systems are broken, that we're blowing past those things that we think we can do and go, what are the numbers? And then they'll start driving, well, how do you change that outcome? And again, it's the analogy of the pedaling the bicycle. If I can only pedal the bicycle so fast, then I can't adjust a disaster to fit what I'm capable. I have to then reorganize and rethink how I'm going to change outcome. The injured only have a finite amount of time before I reach them. I have to get into areas. I have to promote safety and a sense of security. I have to get in medical and other types of commodities in there to stabilize populations. I have a window of probably not more than about 72 hours to do a lot of this stuff. And too oftentimes, our plans are around what we're capable of doing, what our systems are designed to do, not based upon what can happen and what the needs are going to be. So to me, catastrophic planning allows us to do that, but also take it beyond the government-centric approach to problem solving. We put our blinders on and we think we are, again, as one of our primary functions is to promote safety and security, whether it's in a disaster or just day-to-day, as an inherently government function, and not understand that in large-scale disasters, it's a community issue, and that if we're not engaging the community at all levels across the spectrum of resources, we're not going to be effective at changing the outcomes.
So in our earlier segment, you touched on the fact that the ability or the tools that we all have to be able to collect information when there is an event have changed dramatically over the course of the last, say, decade or so. Can you talk a little bit about FEMA's strategic principles for situation awareness and what's changing in the organization as far as visibility pre and post event?
An observation I made, and this was back in Florida, after Hurricane Andrew, we thought we learned a lesson that because the impact and damages in Homestead and Florida City resulted in the initial reports from Dade County that looks like we dodged a bullet because of the absence of reports coming out of extreme southern Miami-Dade County. Well, the reason there was no reports was their communication system was gone and most of the community was destroyed. So the thought was, what we need to do is build better recon and assessment tools, get in-site videos. At that time, it was mainly getting teams in their communications, flying with helicopters, getting subject matter experts to do better recon, better assessments to tell us how bad is bad. Interesting thing, though, was that even as we got better at that, it was still taking us the better part of 2 to 3 days to get into the area with the resources because we assessed first, responded second. So I changed the dynamics in Florida and says, well, why don't we just respond like it's bad? Well, they said, well, that could be very wasteful. It may not be that bad. You know, you won't know what you'll need. And I'm like, well, let's just do what I call the game of beer and pizza math. And that is, if you know how many people live there, then just figure out what they're going to need and send it. Well, it may not be that bad. I'm like, it may not. We'll get done quicker. But how do you make up time? And there's so much emphasis put on, we got to know what's going on, that we forget that you got to keep the patient alive. The analogy is if you're a trauma patient, they want to run a CAT scan and you got an axe in your head. What should you do first? Oftentimes, we spend a lot of time trying to get official source of information, send people in to tell us what's going on. I'm like, okay, they told us it's really bad. What have we changed? Why don't we just make the assumption, particularly when we have something occurring of that magnitude, that it's bad until proven otherwise? And then let's use the public to help us define that area better. Again, we're seeing so much information coming out from the public through a variety of sources in the social media world. But again, they're discounted because they're not official. But I'm kind of going, if I know I have wildfires in this area and I have somebody sending me streaming video of their house burning down, I'd actually consider that pretty good information, even if it wasn't from an official source. But it goes back to, we treat the public as a liability. We don't trust the public. We always look at the negatives and we never look at the positives. Yes, people could do those things. But as we've seen time and time again, one or two individuals, but you rarely see entire communities putting out bad information, and they tend to self-correct faster. But because it didn't come from an official source, we don't trust it. But I've been around disasters to know that the early information from a lot of official sources is officially wrong most of the time anyway. Nothing is as good or as bad as initially reported in these types of events. So why not use the public to help fill in the gaps and not totally depend upon them, but recognize that they can give us more contextual information than just sending people in to say, yeah, it's bad. Well, now did I send the right resources in? But the time you lose waiting for official assessments and confirmation when we're in a response mode is time you cannot make up. And again, too many people are wrapped around, well, we need to be cost effective. We need not to have mistakes. I'm like, we'll get there when we're stabilized. But when we're stabilized, it kind of goes back to this. I can be fast, I can be cheap, or I can be accurate. Pick one. And until we're stabilized, I want to be fast. I think governors and their teams need to be operating in that mode. We need to be supporting them in that mode. And yes, we will over-respond most of the time. But it's better to do that than to under-respond when you can never make up the time and get behind a disaster and lose lives that you could have saved and stabilize the situation when that window is very short.
What about the importance of personal preparedness? We will ask Craig Fugate, FEMA Administrator, to share with us when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.